So to get back to that serial versus epic, you know, I'm trying to get a sense of you know, how the West Coast has and the Pacific Rim for that matter. And, you know, the Rex Roth quote from the Morris Graves essay about how we on the West Coast owe more to Asian traditions than we do to European traditions. And this notion of the serial poem as opposed to the epic, I think, is an important distinction. You know, with the epic, we've got this sense of the European and thus the American, you know, hero, the white knight coming to the rescue, whether it's John Wayne or the, you know, the Knights of the Round Table or whoever. But we on the West Coast maybe don't buy into that as readily. Do you agree with that?
Well, I think literarily, I mean, in terms of pop culture, we certainly do buy into it. But in speaking of the literary community, I think there's a great deal of skepticism about that sort of thing. And that skepticism really arose with people like Robinson Jeffers. Jeffers was the first West Coast poet. And we owe a great deal to Jeffers, including his severe questioning of Western cultural traditions. So that's sort of built into us as West Coast poets. But also, this is newer land than the East Coast. We white invaders, and we rub shoulders with Native Americans constantly, whereas in New York City and Boston, not so much,
In front of the cigar store, maybe.
So we're open to that deeper sense of what we would call biodiversity, both among humans and non-human species. Linguistically, I would bet that most sort of white East Coast type literary people, their second language is French. I mean, not all of them, and there's some, you know, Italian speakers and German speakers and etc., but French is sort of the dominant literary language. And it was French that really gave us our American poetry. The big influences on Pound and Williams, and the people who came after Pound and Williams, were French. So you can say that American poetry has been hugely shaped by the French poets.
Rimbaud, Mallarmé, and people like that.
Sure. But on the West Coast, beginning with people like Gary Snyder especially, but even before Snyder, you think of people like, what's his name, the Chinese translator, Winter Bynner. Guys like Winter Bynner, and those anthologies of Chinese poems had an enormous effect on American poetry across the board. I once wrote an essay claiming that Pound's Cathay was the most influential book of the 20th century. It's just 14 poems and 14 short poems by Lee Bo. And yet, that really brought that personal short lyric poem into American poetry. It didn't exist that way before. On the West Coast, we had the beginnings of a Zen Buddhist practice in America. And we had poets like Gary Snyder, Phil White, and Kenneth Rexroth who studied seriously Asian cultures and languages. And that had a huge impact on all of us, much more than learning to speak French, for instance. If you're not a real student of Chinese or Japanese here, chances are your second language is Spanish. And there's a much bigger Spanish population that's not Puerto Rican. I don't mean to exclude Puerto Ricans from anything. It's just that so many Puerto Ricans moved to places like New York City. They created islands of basically Puerto Rican culture, which is fine. I'm not being critical. I'm just pointing out that in the West, we had migrant workers, we had indigenous peoples. All of these things were there around us all the time, and we were aware of them. So it's really a different sensibility between the West Coast and the East Coast.
In fact, if you look at the mission of San Juan Capistrano, it goes back to 1776, which, when you think about it, on the East Coast, they were starting a country. On the West Coast, it was a Spanish colony at that
Yeah.
time. Yeah. Jeffers, you know, was trained in the classics,
Oh,
spoke
yeah.
Latin and Greek, and yet, and so, in a way, he's this pinnacle of Western philosophy who came to the edge of the continent said, basically, it dies here, is basically his conclusion. And then he comes up with this notion of inhumanism, which is sort of a crude attempt to suggest that we need to recognize our true place in the scheme of things.
Yeah.
Which has very...
It was his objection to living in an anthropomorphic universe. Yeah. Or an anthropocentric universe.
Right. What are some of the other characteristics of a West Coast and Pacific Rim poetics?
Open space in our poems. Poems about mountain ranges. Poems about deserts. Poems about prairies. Poems about living among animals. These were the norm to us. You know, the East Coast idea of nature is thorough. Who, you know, on most nights walk for 20 minutes over to Emerson's house to get dinner, while, you know, proclaiming his, you know, love of, quote, nature, unquote, and saying that he could be happy living in an ammo box, which is absurd. But it takes a Hayden Carruth 100 years later to point out the absurdity of such an idea. Whereas so many of us in the West, we grew up around cattle ranches and sheep ranches, and there were mountains to climb and places to wander, a lot of wandering in West Coast poetry.
And you learn how you...
On the other hand, it took a very long while for us to develop any kind of urban poetry at all. I mean, if you look at much of West Coast poetry, where does our urban voice begin to arise? You know, well, sometimes maybe in Rexroth, but, you know... Maybe Retke? I don't know. Whereas the urban voice is a constant in East Coast poetry. If they have a different kind of richness. I'm not, you know, making this an either or. I'm just pointing out a difference.
Yeah, you're making the distinction. Right,
yeah.
Exactly. And it's almost the sense that this is a very young literary culture still.
Oh, yeah.
And,
yeah, yeah.
In one way, it's a deficit because it's not mature. But in the other way, it's here, ours, for the shaping.
Well, and in some ways, it's a deeply mature tradition because of our tendency to be more involved in what we would call deep ecology or deep anthropology. When I was a child, for instance, understanding a little bit about Navajo and Hopi culture was just profound as all hell. And that's something you wouldn't likely get going to school in, you know, like Virginia. I mean, you might learn about the five civilized tribes, but you learn about them in a kind of remote way. Whereas here, I had friends who were Navajo and Hopi. And, you know, going to a sweat the first time, that's a kind of Western, Southwestern experience that's really bound up in a sense of place. And a sense of pre-American white male domination. And you begin to see that on the real, you know, it was once pointed out to me, if you do a line a mile long, the last 1 inch of that line would cover all of the history of humanity. And the beginning of that line is the beginning of planet Earth. So it tells you what a very tiny little bit of history we as human beings actually occupy.
It's a flash.
And when you look at it that way, you can understand why somebody like Pound or Rexroth would insist that genius is always contemporary, and that Sophocles is as contemporary today as he ever was. You simply have to have eyes and ears to see and hear.
The West Coast... Beat movement, interest in Buddhist culture, that's had an effect on the culture period, hasn't it?
It's what?
It's had an effect on the culture period.
Oh, of course it has. Of course it has. You know, without the beat scene in the 50s, there wouldn't have been any hippies. The hippies were just sort of the popularization of some aspects of the crazier edges of the beat movement. Anytime you have a movement, there's always a lunatic fringe. And there are always more movement followers than movement makers. And followers are, whatever else they are, followers. So Rexroth, Duncan, Snyder, etc., they created a spark that started a fire, part of which burned out of control. If you look at the beat writers, there were all of these fringe people. There were really only five or six of them who are actually really remarkable writers. And there were all of these sort of fringe types who were, you know, became a cliche. You know, women wearing black leotards and hanging out late at night in smoky jazz clubs, and the romance of all of that.
And the guy with the beret and the bongos.
Sure.
Dobie Gillis kind.
Sure, and the you know, curiously studious,
yeah.
Hipness to be hip. You simply had to be hip. That was essential. I mean, that's largely a waste of time being hip.
You're hip, aren't you?
That's very hip.
I'm going back.
I wasn't just hip, I was cool.
Which begs the question that Tower Power asked, what is hip?